listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The headlines from sub-Saharan Africa are often grim, whether it's instability and war, statistics about poverty and disease, government corruption, or death sentences for homosexuals. Nigerian-American journalist Dayo Olapade says that in the midst of all that bad news, we are overlooking the many small solutions that are devised every day across Africa and affect millions of people each day. She's written about some of these innovative solutions and the people who devise them in her book, The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Hi there. Great
now,
to be here.
You start the book with a look at maps. Why are maps so important to understanding our different understandings of Africa?
Well, maps are how you get from point A to point B, just about anywhere in the world. And what's unusual about maps as they relate to Africa is that, for the most part, they've been externally imposed. I think if you took a look at the pre-colonial map, if you look at the kingdoms, if you looked at the tributaries and rivers, they would bear a stark difference with the maps, the political map you see today. And so I set out to try and reorient our understanding of Africa by looking at not just the geographic borders, but the kind of cultural and sort of business-like tools that people can use to reorient themselves.
Well, could we just remake the map? Of course, there were no maps before Africa was suddenly divided up into various colonies, and there were artificial lines that separated one, you know, Benin from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that's actually a very relevant example. I mean, my tribe, which is the Yoruba people, were split between southwestern Nigeria and Benin, and by dint of colonialism, speak two different languages, French and English. As you're seeing today, I think the road from Lagos, Nigeria, all the way to Ivory Coast is now a sort of peri-urban region of commercial activity, where people cross borders, where people trade with one another, where people interact. And so while we have the same official map of Africa, I think many people are working around those arrangements and sort of living life independently of these externally imposed constraints.
Are we trying to map Africa's growth and successes using the wrong standards then, the wrong maps?
I think very much so. I think when one examines development practice, particularly as it relates to Africa, much of the conversation is focused on formal statistics, official borders, working with a ministry, working with governments. And these state-based relationships take up all the oxygen when, in my experience, the most interesting and dynamic activity, the most exciting innovations, and the most relevant types of daily life are happening well outside the umbrella of official processes. And so that's what I set out to cover, and that's what I set out to spotlight as we think about development practice in Africa and elsewhere.
So you write about five maps in this book: family, technology, commerce, nature, and youth.
Yes.
Not nationhood, but not tribes either.
Correct. I think family is an interesting canopy that encompasses obviously real relations, but also what I refer to as an information neighborhood, which is the people around you who inform you about best practices on farming, who can help you bridge a loan for something. And so this conception of family doesn't necessarily relate to things like tribe and religion or other cleavages we might normally refer to, but rather community. And it's this communitarian sensibility that I think we've overlooked when we try and divide Africa based on these central hierarchies and bureaucracies.
Well, Africa is an enormous continent. Did you decide to focus on just a few countries for some reason? Although you often talk about Africa as a whole. Well, I guess we mean sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes. I focus on sub-Saharan Africa in part because the region and the countries have been sorely underestimated. I think more than Latin America, more than Eastern Europe, more than other developing regions of the world, including East Asia, Africa still suffers from this sort of this bias, this narrative of disarray, this narrative of dysfunction. And even as these other emerging markets, so-called, have been given their fair due, I think sub-Saharan Africa needed a concentrated look at this.
And we shouldn't be looking at the oil-producing area of Nigeria and all the corruption that's involved in that and the people who are rebelling against the central government because they feel that they've been cheated out of their birthright. Shouldn't we be talking about that as well? Or is that just what we only focus on?
I think The narrative of corruption, particularly in Nigeria, my country, is one that certainly deserves airtime and I think does get a lot of it. I think what I was most interested in was explaining how many people deal with energy shortages. I mean, I think as someone who's a member of the diaspora, the idea that we could be sitting here in the studio, Leonard, and the lights would just go off, you know, that's unthinkable. Whereas in Nigeria, even though it is an oil-producing country, it's
one of the largest in the world.
That's right. Still imports refined petroleum. And so while the oil theft and the corruption in that sector has been well documented, what hasn't been documented is a lot of community responses to distributed off-grid energy solutions, to conservationist techniques, to other workarounds to this deficiency.
You note that annually the entire African continent consumes about as much energy as New York State.
That's correct. I think if you extend that to water, I think the North Americans use about 40 gallons of water a day to cook, clean, wash. In Africa, and I can attest to this, you can do the same with about 2 gallons or less.
But to some degree, this is by necessity, isn't it? Because the infrastructure is less reliable. Most Africans can't afford many of the gadgets that a typical New Yorker assumes they would have to rely on.
Well, I won't go as far as agreeing with your last statement. I'll agree that it's driven by necessity. But I think one of the things I hope people will take away from the reporting I've done is that there are plenty of people in a sort of emerging middle class in Africa, as well as people, you know, who are fairly cosmopolitan, who use smartphones, who are online. Kenya, where I lived while I was reporting this book, has a very robust presence on social networks such as Twitter. And while this connectivity and this engagement is not as widespread as it is in the United States, it shouldn't be assumed that folks are left out of this conversation. To your first point, I think necessity certainly does drive a lot of these innovations. And some of the things that folks in a country like the United States might think are pitiful or cause for concern are actually incredibly motivating drivers of solutions. You know, if I often say necessity is the mother of invention, you know, Africa may be the mother of necessity. And so it's where one ought to look for solutions to these kinds of problems that might help us, particularly even in developed countries like the United States.
My guest is Dayo Olopade. Her book, The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa. You had an op-ed piece in this past Sunday's New York Times, and you wrote that you dislike the word developing as in developing nation. What do you prefer instead?
I tend to use the term emerging markets. I also use fat and lean. Mostly in the book, I end up referring to lean economies because I want to emphasize the positive aspects of efficiency and the creativity that is generated by resource scarcity. Because I think those things are much more positive ways to think about the African continent. And also, I think, provide some introspective material for folks in wealthy economies to think about their consumption, to think about the things they take for granted, to think about how they accept products as marketed to them, and to maybe think about other ways of examining how we live our lives in these fat economies.
Well, what might be some of the benefits of being a lean economy?
Well, I mean, in the first place, I think there are problems that we don't have in the U.S. I mean, I'll use the example of mobile financial services, which maybe some of the listeners are familiar with. But in Kenya, where I lived, a service known as M-Pesa powers financial inclusion for, you know, 86% of the country now. And it allows one to use a mobile phone as a bank account. This is in a region where there are 2,500 ATMs for 40 million people and almost 70% of the population across the entire continent of sub-Saharan Africa are underbanked. And
this is Kenya, which is one of the more successful economies in Africa.
It's not just a matter of the success as a general economy, but mobile money has been this explosive project there that has seen parrot-type programs pop up in, you know, more than a dozen other countries. But mobile financial services, again, when you don't have a bank, when you don't have an ATM, when all you have is your cell phone starts to become more than a single use. And we don't see that kind of innovation in the United States because we've evolved beyond that. We're unable to access this sort of innovation because it wouldn't occur to us on some level. And so I'm hoping that people will try and think differently. I call it lean thinking, but what I really mean is thinking creatively about how we use resources, and not just driven by the scarcity that you see in Africa, but by the need for all societies to sort of think differently about consumption in the 21st century.
Are the lean economies one of the reasons that Africa largely avoided the worst of the financial meltdown, although obviously there were ripple effects?
Yes, but I think on some level the long-standing distaste on the part of Western investors for engaging with African markets left us out of the consumption fueled financial crisis.
Well, to some degree, isn't that also because of the instability of governments? I just saw a film called Big Men about somebody who was made arrangements to get oil out of Ghana. There are oil fields that were discovered there. Made it with the last government. The next government came in. They said, obviously, bribes had been paid. And the next thing you know, this guy who had invested millions and millions of dollars into developing these fields is out.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many stories like that.
I don't want to discount the level of corruption that persists across many African countries. That said, I think the risk is overblown. For example, the World Bank runs an investment guarantee fund called the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, which means they'll pay out in case your stuff gets expropriated, someone steals it. This fund was set up in 1988. They've paid out since then only 7 times, and only twice in Africa. So I think the idea that doing business in Africa is somehow more risky than doing business in, I don't know, Russia, is something that Africa is being held hostage by and may not, in fact, reflect reality on the ground.
There are some pretty basic problems that many African countries face: stability, reliable infrastructure, disease, poverty, hunger. Do we in the fat countries tend to overlook the fact that people are still living their daily lives within that?
I think far from overlooking, it is almost the only thing that individuals in the United States perceive about Africa. And I think
so we overlook the solutions.
Well, no, I just think, you know, if you're thinking about the pie, right, I would say 80 to 90% of it is images either from news organizations who cluster around every burgeoning crisis, whether it's, you know, a conflict in Eastern Congo, oil corruption in Nigeria, a mining disaster in South Africa, a conflict in Central African Republic. I'm not going to pretend those don't exist, but they get a lot of the airtime. The rest of it is made up from, you know, the charity economy, who is peddling images of disempowerment, lack of agency, and extreme want in a self-serving way. That's my position. And so between these two, the sort of the bad news and the bad aid, you end up with an image of Africa that doesn't reflect what's going on the ground.
Well, I was leading into a conversation of kanju.
Hmm. Right.
What is kanju?
Kanju is a word I've coined to refer to the specific creativity that emerges in the face of African difficulty. It's a Yoruba word. There are other versions of this in different African languages, but as well as in other countries. But the concept is basically that, you know, when driven by necessity to create a solution, whether it's the 10 kilometers that you need to walk to school, whether it's figuring out how you're going to source some sort of clean water, whether you're going to put uniforms on your kid for school, whatever it is, how you're going to deal with the energy problem with the lights going on all the time. It's a real generative, it's a generative thing. For example, you know, mobile phone charging is often a very brisk business, right? There's one person in the community that will have some kind of electrical power, and they'll charge other people to charge their cell phones. And people, again, people who are very poor will see value in having their cell phone charged, and so will pay for it. And so taking these people seriously as consumers allows someone to make a profit. And I would add, products that deal with this kind of business model have been developed. Phoenix is one company that has put together a box where someone can solar charge, you know, a device that can charge up to 16 phones. So design that partners with these existing workarounds and understands the needs, the business case for doing this kind of work in Africa, can actually accelerate people's ability to get the things that they need.
Dayo Alapade has reported from Africa for The Atlantic, The Daily Beast, Foreign Policy, The New Republic, The New York Times, Washington Post. She has written a book called The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Dayo Alapade, who is currently a Knight Law and Media Scholar at Yale Law School. Her book, The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You were reporting from Africa as a freelancer?
Yes, that's correct. I chose to set up shop in Nairobi, Kenya, in part because I was chasing this incredibly interesting tech story. We talked about M-Pesa. I think there's quite a lot of very interesting innovation that derives from connectivity, which, you know, when I started to report this book, this was in 2009, you know, the East African coast had just been connected to the internet. I mean, with fast fiber optic cables before it had been based on satellites and very slow connections percolating through Europe. So I made a beeline for East Africa as someone who has spent a lot of time in West Africa as a Nigerian, and in trips to 17 different countries over the next 3 years, really tried to flesh out a portrait of what's going on the ground.
You're right that one of the problems that the West prefers to look at institutions, not people, and statistics, and not individuals. Why is that problematic for a continent like Africa?
Well, I think it tends to flatten out important distinctions. When you're looking at a figure like GDP, that is the sort of lingua franca of macroeconomics, and yet the GDP of a country, I'll use Ghana as an example. In the coastal cities, Accra being the largest, some of the port cities like Tema as well have large populations. The standard of living, the amount of income, all of those things are significantly different than, you know, hundreds of kilometers up into the country. And so when you have a GDP statistic that puts everyone in the same bucket, it's just not very precise.
Well, how is that any different than in the United States, where people earn a lot more in New York than they do in a farming area?
Oh, I think it's precisely the same illogic. My argument, as applied to Africa, is that these statistics drive so much decision making, and institutional thinking drives so much decision making. It really boggles my mind how inflexible and imprecise these kinds of designations can be, and that the disproportionate amount of influence that these kinds of understandings have on outcomes in Africa.
Isn't part of the problem that much of the economic activity is informal and improvised, so it's hard to come up with hard and fast statistics?
I mean, that's precisely the issue, right? I mean, when I think about the big informal sector businesses in Africa, besides, you know, petty trade or folks, you know, just trying to charge mobile phones or sew clothing, I think about transportation. Yes, there are formal systems in some cities for probably the major ones or the capitals, where you can take a bus, it's got a fixed fare, and, you know, it's operated by the government. But the vast majority of transportation everywhere else, you know, I've taken speedboats, I've taken motorcycles, I've taken taxis that I share with other people. The Matatu bus, which is known by other names in different countries, is, you know, an ostensibly 14-passenger van that I've seen packed with 25 people. They run on informal routes that everyone knows, but they're completely operating outside the purview of the state. And that's how everyone in Africa gets from place to place.
Interestingly, we have things like that in New York City as well. But
that's correct. But, the jitney cab.
Yeah, but they are only known to the few people who avail themselves of that service.
Right. I think when you're talking about transportation or any other potentially government administrated service, whether it's electricity or something else, the state only reaches so far, right? It hasn't, you know, we can talk about the inauthenticity of African states, but their lack of competence is as important in driving the kinds of conju solutions I'm talking about. If the electricity doesn't get to your house, if the water doesn't get to your house, if the bus line doesn't get to your house, you must invent a new way. And so that just ends up leaving out, looking at states ends up leaving out all of that activity.
So do many Africans not trust their national governments?
I can't speak for, you know, 800 million people, most of whom I haven't met. But in my experience, it's not a matter of distrust so much as a lack of expectation. You know, it's the what have you done for me recently question that all citizens in all countries around the world ask themselves. And the answer in most countries in Africa, with very few exceptions, is not much. You know, we talked about the transport, the energy, the water problems. But in the vast majority of countries, you know, democracy, elections, all of the trappings of civil society that we value in the United States end up not having much of an impact on the daily lives of individuals. You know, the posters come down from the walls, people go back to their daily lives, and they don't expect much. Public schools are another great example where, you know, they've been made free, which is great. It's part of the Millennium Development Goals. But they're still very poor in terms of quality, and they're very overcrowded, and teachers don't teach. So it's this accountability problem that is pervasive in sub-Saharan Africa that has led people to expect very little from the state.
You write about Ushahidi, which was developed during the violence that followed the 2007 election in Kenya, and crowdsourced locations where violence had taken place. Has that idea been used in other contexts since then?
Well, it's been used in and out of Africa. My experience with Ushahidi was during both the Liberian and the Nigerian elections in 2011. Wherein the new tools that had been developed, as you mentioned, in 2008 to deal with Kenya's post-electoral crisis had been transported to the elections that went on in both of those countries. And in my observation, it wasn't so much the tools. Again, I think there is a tendency to assume that technology by itself can generate solutions and really solve problems and be more efficient, which it can. But it is when it is layered upon existing infrastructures that are often human that technology has the most impact, where it can amplify what's already going on. And so in Nigeria, I found a population, particularly young people, who were sort of fed up with the way the government had sort of ignored them and not provided any good jobs for people. And so there was a real interest in engaging with sort of watchdoggery, for lack of a better word, to make sure that the people voted, that there was no, in Nigeria we would say wahala, which is problems. And so an engaged public plus an interesting tech tool together provided, I think, more accountability. And, you know, people also were able to do this because they had some smartphone hardware or just basic cell phone hardware in their hands. So it was this real marriage of tools, both software and hardware, and a sort of spirit of accountability.
My guest is Dayo Olopade, O-L-O-P-A-D-E. Her book, The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have a chapter called Stuff We Don't Want, and you include secondhand T-shirts and Tom's shoes, which donates a pair of shoes to poor communities for each pair that it sells, I guess. Mm. Why do you think those well-intended efforts are misguided?
Well, on the one hand, they're executed from afar. On the other, I think both of those initiatives, I talk about 1 million shirts, which was a very misguided effort to donate, to send a dollar and a T-shirt that would be sent to Africa in an undifferentiated way.
I see a lot of photographs of people wearing T-shirts that
I'm sure I would recognize. Yes, I'm sure the Denver Broncos Super Bowl championship T-shirts are probably on a container ship heading for some poor country right now. But you know, if I could urge anyone to do anything about this economy, is that sending gift in kind privileges the things you have lying around. It privileges your experience, your convenience, much more than the intended recipients. This is why I don't like or condone the model of Tom's shoes as well, because, you know, the problem is not lack of shoes in a poor community. The problem is lack of jobs, lack of stability, lack of the ability to plan based on the kind of the poverty that might drive someone not to have shoes. And so with respect to making these kinds of donations, it just doesn't reflect any choice or any agency on the part of the person who might be receiving it. And if it's about you and it's about your brand being differentiated by the existence of poverty, avoid that.
Well, doesn't it also cut down on the possibility that some local company could make its own T-shirts? They can make their own shoes. Once you start receiving charity, things come free. That means that local solutions are eliminated.
Yes, that's quite right, Leonard. I think as my understanding of the textile industry in West Africa, to limit the example, is that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there was a comparatively robust textile industry. Mali is a large producer of cotton, and yet the country has not manufactured, you know, a single T-shirt in years, in part because the flood of imports, the Denver Bronco shirts, tend to crowd out this existing economy, which is, you know, an unfortunate turn of events, given that the thing that people might really want is the job that would allow them to make a shirt or to make shoes rather than the good, the T-shirt or the shoe themselves.
Well, you grew up in the United States first, right? So was there culture shock when you went to Africa? Or did you start going young enough so that you were part of both worlds?
I mean, the perspective I bring to this reporting project is certainly one of a diaspora African. It's someone who's a first-generation American, whose parents were educated in Nigeria and came to the U.S. Many years ago. And I think that has offered me the ability to sort of see the difference between different types of societies and the way they approach consumption, the way they approach innovation, the way they approach education. And I think I'm thinking about growing up, you know, my grandmother, who lived with us for a time in Chicago, where I grew up, would, you know, always have this kind of this attitude toward conservation, this attitude towards making sure that we were not wasting resources. And that, as well as, you know, being surrounded by the language, surrounded by family, like spending time going back to Nigeria, prevented me from experiencing any real culture shock.
But you were seeing both fat and lean economies.
Right.
Did you notice the difference when you were young?
I will say this. I mean, my parents are medical doctors, and their approach to they always commented to me about the difference between fat and lean. They didn't put it in those terms, but when they were being trained at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria in the early 70s, there were no CT scans. There wasn't a lot of sort of equipment, and while the education was first class, the limited resources required them to be more efficient in the way that they diagnosed patients and in the way that they treated patients. You know, if you go to a hospital in the U.S., you might, depending, be put into a CT scan, and then, you know, they'll look at it, they'll have a cup of coffee, they'll tell you what's wrong, and they'll send you to the doctor. It'll all be very expensive, and it'll all be insured. Whereas, you know, my parents had to get very good with the stethoscope and the other sort of analog tools of medical practice. And I think that really does define the difference between fat and lean. And there are plenty of other ways in which that's true, but that's just one limited example.
Well, didn't you contract malaria in Nigeria in 2011?
Yes.
you came down with the symptoms while you were back in the United States. Would you have received the same kind of health care if you had remained in Nigeria?
I mean, it would have been literally thousands of dollars less expensive, and probably have been more efficient in terms of the time it took.
Because they see a lot of malaria, whereas we don't see too much of it in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated case, right? I think I was very much a specimen at the hospital where I had been admitted, because there is no – it's very, very unusual to see malaria in the U.S. But for listeners who aren't aware, malaria tends to percolate in your bloodstream for weeks. So I had returned to the U.S. after the Nigerian elections, which is, I believe, when I got malaria. And I was just blown away, having not been very sick much of my life, to be in a hospital where there were, you know, there were machines and there were tests. And there was this kind of fearfulness about diagnosis that I hadn't really encountered at the sort of clinics where I would get medicine. And just to change the example from my own is, you know, tuberculosis is a very complicated disease that mutates easily, that is highly contagious, and that is a real epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa. We have great diagnostic tools to deal with tuberculosis. We know how to do it. It's fairly expensive. But if you ask someone whether they've lost weight, if you ask someone if they have a cough, if you ask them if they feel chilly, that gets you 85% of the way to knowing whether someone has tuberculosis without all the rigmarole. So I don't know. I think, you know, I might not have wanted an open heart surgery, you know, at a clinic in Kenya, but I think that there are real opportunities to think differently about health.
But aren't there also problems? For example, you can't always trust the drugs. There's a large black market in antimalarials, and you're never sure whether you're getting the, mm-hmm. the drug that you need. There have been solutions devised by Bright Simons.
Yes. This is one of my favorite stories from the book because it's just the kind of thing you would never come up with in the United States. Again, because you didn't have those sort of driving forces of bad infrastructure and bad states and no FDA and that sort of thing, or an ineffective one in Nigeria. So counterfeit drugs are a big problem in Africa, and it's really one of the worst things. These are the worst people in the world. They're counterfeiting the drugs that save lives, the high-value ones, the ARV drugs, other things like that. And so I have family members who have purchased anti-malarials that have been inert or, in some cases, you know, have things that can really hurt you. So this innovation tries to offer consumers control at the point of sale by looking at the drug they buy, doing a little scratch-off, kind of like, let's say, a lottery ticket, and they'll be able to check using their cell phone to see whether the drug is real or fake.
Now, we have very little time, but I'm going to ask you the big question. What can the West do to help Africa work out its own problems?
Well, I think one of the biggest and least leveraged resources is the private sector in Africa. Again, I told you the oxygen is being, you know, all the oxygen is where the state is, where institutions are, the World Bank, the UN, governments, meeting with ministers. I think the private sector in Africa is one of the most important levers to employ people, to build solutions, to sell solutions. And I think taking Africa as an investment opportunity is essential to driving, you know, rising incomes, and good solutions to all the kinds of problems that still exist, but, you know, will not persist forever.
Dayo Olapade's book, The Bright Continent: Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.